Well, this evening I want to talk about the symmetry of Jesus. The symmetry of Jesus. What do I mean? Well, some buildings are beautiful and some buildings are ugly. What do you think about Amiens Park Chapel? So what makes a building beautiful? Well, what makes a building beautiful is its proportions. And the more correct those proportions, the greater the harmony between them, the more perfect the symmetry, the greater the beauty. Nothing jars. Nothing is out of place. There's nothing distorted or distended. The lines are pleasing, satisfying, symmetrical. And so when we look at Jesus Christ, what do we see? We see a beautiful symmetry. Now, I'm not talking about his appearance. We don't know what Christ looked like. Now, the Bible simply tells us he had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. Jesus wasn't strikingly handsome. He looked very ordinary. If you've seen a photograph of Jesus with the 12 disciples, it would have been difficult to tell which of them was Jesus. He just looked like anybody else. Nothing remarkable. Nothing impressive. So the symmetry of which we're speaking is Jesus' character. The man that he was and the man that he continues to be. Now listen to the Apostle John. We had it in our reading. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then verse 14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Now, John's language is very precise. He says the Word was God. The Word became flesh. So the Word was always God, but he was not always flesh. He became what he had not been without ceasing to be what he was. God became a man without ceasing to be God. And Jesus is his name. Wonderful. It's profound. Here is the Word. Here is the Son. Really, fully, truly, essentially, personally, God. But the Word became flesh. He becomes really, fully, truly, essentially, personally, human. With a human body, a human mind, human emotions, with all the limitations that that means to be human. Except he was without sin. And John tells us the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. So Jesus wasn't a man in heaven, protected, insulated, safe. He dwelt among us, among the disease and the poverty and the squalor of first century Palestine. He dwelt among us, among the stupid and the proud and the violent. He dwelt among us. He dwelt in a world of sinners. He dwelt in the world of his enemies. It was here, in the very nitty-grittiness of life, says John, that we beheld his glory. The glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. It was here, in this world, that we beheld that symmetry, the beauty of Jesus Christ. The symmetry of Jesus. Well, we have three things to say this evening. The first is this. To look at Jesus' symmetry from the angle of relationships. Now, after my mother died, someone said to me, "You've only got one mum." And Jesus had a mum. And one day, he had to say goodbye to her. Only it was he who was dying. And this is what he said. John 19, verse 25. Now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved, that's John, standing by, He said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Not pointing to himself, he's pointing to John. And he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, that disciple took her to his home. Now, whose suffering is the greatest? Is it Jesus's or his mother's? Who's suffering the more? Well, it's Jesus. He's nailed to a cross. But as he looks at his mother, he knows that her heart is breaking. So as a loving son, taken up with the welfare of his mother, he trusts his mother into the care of John. Jesus dies loving others. And his relationships with his friends, his disciples. Now, how would you cope with brothers James and John? They are brothers. How would you cope with them? Jesus nicknamed them sons of thunder because of the speed and the violence of their reactions. We all know people like that, don't we? They're like a clap of thunder when they go. And how would you get on with Peter? He's a big bear of a man, isn't he? And he's full of contradictions. One minute he's boldly confessing Christ, the next minute he's arguing with him. He's exasperating and he's lovable all at once. And what about Judas? Nursing ambitions which will eventually lead to Jesus' betrayal. And Jesus knows that Judas will betray him. And yet for all that, Jesus' friendship is genuine. His disciples, so many different temperaments, and yet we never read with Jesus and them that there's a personality clash. And they're so slow to learn, and they're arguing about which of them is the greatest, and they're fearful and unbelieving, and they get the wrong end of the stick, and they're jealous, and they're happy, and they're sad, and then they go and put their foot in it. And they sound just like you and me, don't they? Because they're real people. And Jesus, he cultivates their friendship. So what does that tell you about Jesus? It tells you there's nothing phony about him. He doesn't try it on. He doesn't use people for his own ends. Many of his disciples, they're working men. Some of them are fishermen from Galilee. They're very straight-talking, working men. They're suspicious of outsiders. And yet Jesus cultivates their friendship. So it tells you, doesn't it, the sort of friend that Jesus was. And though he is God incarnate, he doesn't lord it over his friends. He comes among them as one who serves. He rolls up his sleeves, gets his hands wet and dirty, washing the feet of others. And he doesn't just cultivate their friendship. All the time he's shaping and training them with that wisdom and gentleness and patience to be his disciples. And these men come to love him because he loved them perfectly, full of grace and truth. What about Jesus' relationships with others? We thought a few weeks ago about the Samaritan woman, didn't we? And as far as she's concerned, there's nothing about men she doesn't know. She had five husbands, she's on to lover number six. And then she meets Jesus. She meets this man who's unlike any other man she has ever met. There's no one like him. She can't believe it. And you can't stop her talking about Jesus. And she says to the men in her village, she says, "Come, see a man who told me all things that I ever did. Could this be the Christ?" And then there's this Oxbridge Don, the greatest teacher in Israel, Nicodemus. He comes to Jesus, and at first he's patronizing. He says, "Oh, Rabbi, we know that you're a great teacher sent from God." He's patting Jesus on the head and saying, "Oh, we know you're somebody special." But he's patronizing him. But Nicodemus soon discovers that actually it's Nicodemus who knows nothing. And actually Jesus has got to take him through the ABCs. You must be born again. This is the Jesus who puts his finger on the sin of what seems to be the most enthusiastic, religious young man you're ever likely to meet. A young man who comes and says, "Oh, good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus cuts through it all and says, one thing you lack, go your way, sell whatever you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Come, take up your cross and follow me. And he was sad at his word and went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. Jesus puts his finger on this man's sin, that he loves money more than he loves God. And then we come to Jesus, and he's dealing with a demon-possessed boy. And before he deals with the boy, he first has to deal with a father who is at his wit's end and doesn't know what to do. And Jesus says to him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. Immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. And do you remember last week, Jesus touching the leper? Jesus comforting the widow of Nain? And then there's Jesus, and despite his punishing schedule and the pressure of time and thousands of hands pressing against him, touching him, holding out their hands to him and saying, give, 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 he finds time to stop and help this woman who for 12 years has had this shameful flow of blood. She's ashamed. She can't come close to anyone. She's ceremonially unclean. She's an outcast. She's blown all her savings on doctors, quack doctors. Jesus is her last hope. She comes, she touches the hem of his garment, and she's healed. But Jesus isn't just concerned to make her well in her body. He won't let her go until he knows it's well with her soul. He says to her, take heart, daughter. Your faith has healed you. Go in peace. And this is the Jesus who welcomes those who've really messed up. So here's a woman, and she's been caught in the very act of adultery, and she's dragged in front of Jesus. And the religious are there, and they're pointing the finger, and they say to Jesus, the law says that she should be stoned. What do you say? And he's the lawgiver. And there and then he rewrites the rules. And he says to them, he who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first. Among you sinners, which of you will condemn this sinner? And the accusers leave one by one. Jesus doesn't leave because he's without sin. And he turns to the woman. He says, woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you? No one, Lord. And while the other sinners, they've walked away from Jesus, this woman stays with Jesus. It's the only safe place for a sinner to be. Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. And we could go on and on and on. We rub shoulders with these people, don't we? We know what people are like. We're amongst these people. And there he is in the nitty-grittiness of life, meeting all these people at times in their greatest need, their greatest distress, the turning point of their life, the defining moment of their existence. And what do we find again and again? Jesus' loveliness just flows out. And then there are his enemies. And what do we find? Well, we find them personal, abusive, scornful, hating him. And how does Jesus respond? Does he give as good as he gets? Never threatens, never reviles, never loses his temper, never becomes critical. You'll never hear him being critical. In fact, you can sum up his attitude to his enemies in his own words. You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. And you shall be sons of your Father in heaven. And he embodies those very words, full of grace and truth. And what strikes you when you look at Jesus' relationships, unlike anyone else we will ever meet, and unlike ourselves, is that Jesus is himself. He is always himself. Whoever he is with, he is the same. He is himself. Are you? A perfect symmetry, full of grace and truth. Well, secondly, Jesus' symmetry from the angle of events. You can think of the cleansing of the temple in John chapter 2. Now, in the temple, where do you put all the animals that need to be sacrificed? And where do you put the money changers so people can change their money into the temple money so they can pay the temple tax? Where do you put all those things? Well, so the Jews, let's put them in the court of the Gentiles. It won't bother us. The only people that would be bothering are the Gentiles. And who cares about them? So the one place in the world where the Gentiles, the non-Jews, can draw near to God, it's filled with bleating and dung and the sharp practice of the money changers. The place of prayer has become a farmyard. And an opportunity, because they're very sharp the way they change their money, opportunity for daylight robbery. So what does Jesus do? John 2, verses 15 and 16. When he had made a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And he said to those who sold doves, take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of merchandise. And he pictured the scene. There's always crates from animals, so there's cords lying around. And Jesus takes up some cords and he makes a whip of cords. Slowly, patiently, making a whip of cords. He's now got a whip. And he burns with a righteous anger. The one place in the world where Gentiles can come and worship God. And you're keeping them out. And with a holy violence, he sends money and people and animals scattering in all directions. And as you watch, Jesus is awesome. He stands alone. Nobody dares stop him. And his astonished disciples, as they watch, the only thing they can think of is that verse, zeal for your house has eaten me up. And yet this same Jesus is relaxed and cool and calm while the disciples are panicking because the boat is sinking in the storm. And we read Jesus arose, he rebuked the wind, he said to the sea, be quiet. And the wind ceased and there was a great calm. Maybe some of you can remember the events of that day in Capernaum. You can read about it in Luke 4. It's an absolutely punishing schedule. It's an exhausting day. And you think, after a day like that, have a good lie in. What do we find? He's up at the crack of dawn. Jesus departed and went into a deserted place, and the crowd sought him and came to him and tried to keep him from leaving them. But he said to them, I must preach the kingdom of God to other cities also, because for this purpose I have been sent. And yet this driven Jesus is the same Jesus who is social, he's easygoing, he's relaxed, he's sitting there eating, drinking at Levi's party. This is a Jesus who denounces the wicked Pharisees. If you want your hair to stand up on the back of your neck, read Matthew 23. Read what he says to the Pharisees. If he said that today, he'd be described as being unchristlike. But read it. Denounce them. It's a blistering attack upon the Pharisees. And this denouncer of wicked men, he weeps over the coming destruction of Jerusalem. Do you see? He's zealous. And he's relaxed. He's driven. He's easygoing. He's fiery. And he's full of compassion. Because he's full of grace and truth. You see, there are people who rail against sin, aren't there? Oh, they really warm to their theme and they can tell you how terrible sin is. But they have no compassion upon the sinner. You never put a messed up person in their hands. They wouldn't last. They wouldn't survive. And then there are independent people who are driven people. They get things done. But they don't know when to sit down and when to relax. And they don't know how to relate to ordinary people. But every time, in every sitting, in every setting and situation, we find this lovely, perfect symmetry of Jesus. And so to number three. Jesus' symmetry seen from the extreme of his sufferings. So there I am, I'm sitting in a comfy chair reading a book. In walks the love of my life with a cup of tea. And all is well with the world. And I smile cheerful and I'm kind and I'm patient and I'm full of goodwill and I can embrace the world and say, I love you all. But then I'm tired and I'm hungry and I'm lonely. I feel rejected and I'm under pressure and everything's going wrong and the world's against me and I'm in pain, I'm in agony. What then? What sort of person am I like then? What do people see then? Because that's actually the real me when I'm under pressure, when you squeeze me tight, when you pinch me hard, then you'll find out what I'm really like. So who's the real Jesus? Who is he when he's under extreme provocation, extreme pressure, extreme suffering? What's he like then? Jesus enters the Garden of Gethsemane. The cross is only hours away. He says to Peter, James, and John, his closest friends, he says, don't leave me. In fact, he actually says, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful even to death. I have sorrows that are enough to kill me. Now, who uses language like that? And as we witness his agony, and as we hear him pray, he says this. He says, Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Take this cup away from me. What cup? Well, you can read about the cup through the Bible. It's spoken of a number of times. It's the cup of God's wrath. It's filled with this spiced wine of God's outpoured judgment. It's like the fury, the fire, the burnings of 1,000,000 volcanic eruptions concentrated into a single coffee mug. And as Jesus looks into it, he's horrified. It's the one thing he fears most, because to drink it means to be engulfed in the anger of God. And he prays, is there another way? What's more, it's not his cup to drink. It's my cup. It's the cup that's reserved for me. I'm the sinner. I'm the rebel. I'm the one who's gone my own way. I'm the one who's provoked God to anger. He doesn't thrust it into my hand and say, here, it's your cup. You drink it. He doesn't cut and run. Yes, he prays, Lord, is there another way? And heaven is silent. No? Well, if there is no other way that guilty men and women, boys and girls can be saved, then I will drink it. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And his fingers tighten around the cup, and he drinks it to his very dregs. And you think, what love is this? It's my cup. But he doesn't thrust it into my hand. He takes it out of my hand and says, I'll drink it to take my cup, the agonies of my hell, and to drink it. We move from Gethsemane to Golgotha, to the cross itself. The Word became flesh. And now that flesh is broken and torn and bleeding. And his emotions are exposed to the hostility and hatred and shouts and scorn of wicked men. And it's a soul that is exposed to the rage and malice of the devil with every temptation and insinuation to curse God and die. And Jesus bearing the sins of the many, he's now exposed to God's hatred of sin. He drinks that cup. And the language of the Bible, he's cut off. He's damned. He's engulfed in the wrath of God, in his flesh, in his body, and emotions, and mind, and souls. He feels the incredible weight and density and compactness of God's anger. And it's infinite, and it's unsustainable. And yet on the cross he endures. He drinks the cup. And the bitter, of the bitterest dregs is that he is then abandoned by his father. My God, why have you forsaken me? He dies for sins not his own. He dies that the guilty can be rescued from hell and at last brought to heaven. And as we watch his extreme sufferings, what do we see? We see no defect, no deformity. It seems to us as we watch, the greater the pressure, the more extreme the suffering, the more his loveliness flows out. And we say he's altogether lovely. There's never been anyone like Jesus Christ. The symmetry of Jesus. Well, it's time to close. We can say some things very briefly. Number one, what is God like? You ever wonder what God is like? Haven't seen him, have you? What's he like? The God who made all this, made the universe and made it out of nothing. The God who made you. The God who gives you life and breath. The God is in whose hands you now live. What's God like? And we're told, aren't we? No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. And Jesus, he is fully God. He becomes a man. And he's come to declare who God is. So as you look at Jesus, there is nothing ungodlike in him. All that Jesus is, God is. There is nothing ungodlike in him. He's the revealer of God. So look at him. That's what God is like. Look at that symmetry. There's no compromise, no contradictions, no sort of balancing of things out. His righteousness is not at the expense of his compassion for the guilty. His power doesn't make him unapproachable. His justice is in harmony with his love. All of God is there to be seen in that life. In him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. God is contracted to a span incomprehensibly made man. Look at the symmetry. Look at the beauty. You are gazing upon God himself. That is what God is like. All of God is in him. We see the godness of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So number two, what's sin like? Well, look at that perfect symmetry. Okay, you see it? Now place your life next to that life. Place your life next to Jesus' life. Now what do you do that he doesn't do? And what does he do that you don't do? And where you deviate from that perfect symmetry, that is sin. That's what it is. It's the deviation from the symmetry of Christ. It's falling short of the glory of God. That's what sin is. So you've seen him tonight, haven't you? You've seen the way he is with people, the way he is in extreme suffering. You've seen him. That is what holiness looks like. Put your life next to it. Are you like it? You're not like it, are you? I'm not like it. None of us are like it. We've all fallen short of that glory. We are so asymmetrical. We're distorted, twisted, corrupt, unlike him. And that's what sin is. Look at that life. That's how you love God with all your heart. That's how you love your neighbor as yourself. But I don't love like that, do I? I don't love God like that. I don't love my neighbor like that. Exactly. Because I'm a sinner. And that's what sin is. It's being unlike Jesus. That's what sin is. It's not being like him. And the Bible tells me that sinners are under a death sentence. Because the wages of sin is death. Well, number three, what's salvation like? Well, it's seeing who Jesus is. It's seeing what I'm like. I'm a sinner. And it's seeing what I'm like, what he's like. If I stay as I am, I'm going to be condemned. So what do? I come to Jesus to save me from my sins. And if I do, my sin is put to his account, and he's condemned, the cross, and his life is put to my account. And I'm accepted, justified, acquitted. That's what salvation is. So number four, what's being a Christian like then? Well, if I come to Jesus to save me, that is just the start. Because Christianity is not a lifestyle. If you want lifestyles, you can go anywhere else. Go to all the religions of the world. They'll give you a lifestyle. Don't come to Christianity for a lifestyle. Come to Christianity for a relationship. It's about a relationship. About a relationship with this Jesus. It's not a case of just admiring that life and saying, oh, isn't that life wonderful? It's coming to love him. And adore him, and trust him, and walk with him, and copy him. So much so that he actually then becomes my life. And my life is filled with him, and I'm taken up with him. Wherever you look in this world, you'll find it spoiled. Okay, there are lovely things in this world, but even the lovely things are not altogether lovely, are they? Yes? Someone has said, even the sun has spots. But Jesus is altogether lovely. He's the only one without fault, blemish, defect. He is altogether lovely. And so what's the Christian life? Well, it's to know him. Isn't that wonderful? To know the most loveliest of all beings? Isn't that wonderful? You know? Not just a case of saying, oh, I've got to be forgiven for my sins, I've got to escape from hell. It's coming to know the most lovely, lovely, loveliest of the loveliest of all beings. And know him, and enjoy him, and worship him. Isn't that wonderful? And to surrender my life to him and say, this life which you've saved, it doesn't belong to me anymore. It's all yours. And I give myself to you. I discover that his loving kindness is better than life. So if I had 1,000 lifetimes, I'd spend them all for Jesus. Because I found him so wonderful. To live all my days for him, and at last to see him face to face. That's the Christian life. It's all about him. You want a lifestyle? Go somewhere else. We're not about lifestyles here tonight. It's about a relationship. It's about Jesus Christ. It's about knowing him. Paul put it like this. He said, to me, to live is Christ. That's what life is to me. It's Christ. And then he says, to die is gain. Because it's more of Christ. I go to be with him. Which brings us to number five. What stops you from being saved tonight? We're not pushing you towards religion. We're inviting you to come to a person. That's the glory of the gospel. We're inviting you to come to Jesus Christ. You've heard all about God and sin and salvation and the Christian life. You've heard all about those things, haven't you? All that remains is that now you come to Jesus. And you know what he's like. And you know the reception you'll get. So come just as you are. Don't get yourself ready and then come. Don't think I've got to bring something with me to impress him or to improve the situation as I am at the moment. Just come as you are, exactly as you are. Add nothing, change nothing, just come as you are. Say, Lord, I messed up, but you died on the cross to save messed up sinners. Well, save me and change me and forgive me. Come just as you are. To this Jesus. Will you come? He stands tonight as he stands every Sunday evening in the preaching. with his arms opened wide to welcome you. So, my friend, what are you waiting for? You've heard it so many times, haven't you? Stop standing at a distance. Now's the time to come to this Jesus Christ. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth.